For most of us, sleep is a part of our lives we take for granted. But maybe we shouldn't, because there is a considerable amount of evidence and research that shows not getting enough sleep, restful sleep, or living with a sleeping disorder can have a great impact on one's health and quality of life. Between a third and a fifth of Americans say they don't get enough sleep. Nearly a third have been diagnosed with a sleep disorder. Half of Americans snore during sleep. 40 million say they fall asleep during the daytime. Sleep plays a major role in our health and well-being. On The Spark, we discuss sleep and why it's an important part of our lives. Our guest is Dr. John Lavery, sleep medicine physician and systems medical director for sleep medicine at UPMC Neurological Institute. Dr. Lavery, good seeing you again.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
All right, so let's start with a basic question. Why is sleep important?
Yeah, it's a basic question with a long answer, but I'll keep it as summarized as I can. So sleep is actually in charge of a lot more than just what I call the on-off switch of consciousness, right? So when we sleep, our brain, our bodies, they're still communicating. Our whole system is still working together to restore our health with a good night's sleep, restore our brain and our cognitions, store and form memories. And I think a concept that might be new to a lot of your listeners would be that the circadian rhythm, the process that governs our sleep and wake cycles, is actually responsible for a lot more than just sleep and wake, but even metabolic health, things like blood sugar levels, things like thyroid hormones, and even stress hormones can all be caught up in how our circadian rhythm is functioning. And so, in brief, sleep impacts every organ system in the body and is essential to overall good health.
Circadian rhythm is two words we hear fairly often, but I get the sense that sometimes people don't know exactly what it is. What is it?
Mm-hmm. So, again, a great question. There's actually some that is understood about our circadian rhythms and some that is not understood about our circadian rhythms. What we know is that the circadian rhythm is the systems and processes in the body and the brain that are communicating and governing different functions, okay? To take it out of the abstract, let's talk about light, because that seems to be the primary signal for which the circadian rhythm operates. So, for example, our circadian rhythm starts for the day when we wake up. So that's why when we give advice like go to bed at the same time and wake up at the same time, it might sound like some throwaway advice, but actually a lot of your bodily processes, metabolism and otherwise, start with the circadian rhythm when you wake up. So keeping that rise time consistent is very good and helps your body to get in a good flow. Okay. Now, as we progress through the day and light starts to dim in the evening hours, that sends a signal to the brain that it's going to be time to go to sleep soon. And when we sleep and when we wake, is affected by these signals. We call them in my field Zeitgebers, I believe it's a German word that I think roughly translates to time givers or something like that. And these are cues to the circadian rhythm on when to go to sleep and when to wake up. And light's the primary one. So another component people have heard of before is melatonin. You know, it's an over-the-counter supplement a lot of people can take. But this is actually a hormone that everybody's brain makes every night. And the main signal is light. So as light, either from sunlight, from artificial light, from screens, from our devices, enters the eyeball, it sends a message to the back of the brain telling the pineal gland not to make melatonin. So light blocks melatonin production in the body. In nature, you know, when we were a more primitive species, as the light would decrease, we didn't have artificial lights, we didn't have iPads, we didn't have laptops, we didn't have, you know, corporate jobs and things like this. So the signal was very strong to our brain to go to sleep as the light decreased. And the pineal gland would make the melatonin, and it would increase over the course of about 2 hours. And basically from sundown to 2 hours later would be the time that you would fall asleep. And so the circadian rhythm is complicated, but it's influenced by different signals, and the primary signal is light, and conversely melatonin.
Nowadays, the way we've evolved, our favorite television programs may be what influences that the most. But I'm curious, we just moved the clocks ahead, daylight savings time, a couple weeks. I'm curious, you as a sleep expert, your opinion of that.
You really opened up Pandora's box here, Scott. So, unfortunately, like most, too many things, this can be a bit political. It shouldn't be, but it can be. So my opinion, and the opinion of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, is that we should preserve standard time. Okay. And a lot of these terms are very confusing, even to me as a sleep physician. I have to think it through to get my thoughts together. So I can only imagine what politicians and lay people think, right? So, when we sprang forward, so to speak, we actually moved off of standard time to daylight savings time. And I think the easiest way to think about this is, on standard time at noon, the sun should be close to, you know, straight up in the air, you know, straight overhead, basically. And so the position of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, in my opinion, would be to preserve standard time, because it can influence what we just talked about, the circadian rhythm. We take our bodily cues from light, as it's the primary signal to our bodies about when to be awake and asleep. And so we should be in communion with nature on that. Now, there are a lot of other things to consider that I don't know much about. I'll confess that there are economic considerations, there are business considerations, there are energy considerations to this daylight savings issue. So I think most people, most politicians are interested in picking something and sticking to it, because we do know that the change is particularly harmful. In fact, this has been studied, and it's been shown that particularly coronary events, heart attacks, have a statistically significant spike when we lose this hour of sleep every year, and it's very consistent. And it is thought to be a direct correlation that this loss of sleep causes enough stress on patients who already have compromised cardiovascular function, heart function, that this stress is enough to actually increase acute coronary events on a consistent basis. So that's one example, but it's a very good example of why this switching back and forth is not good for us. So I think eventually in our country, we will just pick something and go with it. But the official position of the ASM, and I tend to agree on this topic and most topics, that we should just stick with what nature gave us and preserve standard time.
You're right. It has become political. I want to talk about some of the reasons that people don't sleep, sleeping disorders, and what a lot of our listeners can do if they don't sleep that well. Let's talk about, you know, I mentioned in the introduction that many people, and there seems to be, from the statistics that I've read, kind of all over the place, from a third to a fifth of Americans, that's a pretty wide disparity, say they don't get enough sleep. Why not?
Yeah, so the data is a bit broad, as you say. And I think a lot of it, I don't think there's any one issue. I think if you had to give like a generalization, a lot of it's cultural, right? I think there's pretty good data showing that even from 50 years ago, on average, in this country, we sleep an hour less than we used to. So certainly, you know, there's some low hanging fruit, you know, our TV shows, our devices that are, you know, pumping that light into our brains, you know, can delay bedtime. I think most people would agree that if they actually allow themselves to kind of wind down in a quiet, low-lit environment, they might fall asleep earlier than they allow themselves to. But also, you know, you have to consider, why are people doing that in the first place? I think a lot of it is because people work very hard. They have families, they have, you know, a lot of responsibilities, and then they need that just, you know, time to unwind and relax and put their mind on something else for a bit. And that might be as integral to human health as an extra hour of sleep, for all we know at this time. So I don't want to cause anyone any stress or anxiety, like, you know, I'm doing something so bad for my health, when, you know, I certainly experience it where if I don't give myself time to wind down before I actually try to sleep, it doesn't work anyways, right? So I think there are a lot of cultural reasons that we're getting less sleep. I think that's an easy thing to point out. But there could be other reasons. I mean, certainly there's an increase in chronic medical conditions, chronic sleep disorders that are being recognized. And so if we're sicker and have more sleep disorders, we're probably also going to sleep less too, right? So I think there's a lot of reasons.
Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. John Levery, sleep medicine physician and systems medical director of sleep medicine at UPMC Neurological Institute. We're talking about sleep. Dr. Levery, how much sleep should we be getting?
So most adults will say age 25 through 55, that's a large portion where sleep should stay pretty steady, generally benefit from 6 to 9 hours of sleep. Okay. Traditionally, most people say 7 to 8. I say 6 to 9 just to highlight, if you're getting less than 6 on a consistent basis, that's probably not good for your health, and there's probably should be looked at. And if you're getting more than 9 hours of sleep on a consistent basis, again, that can be a sign of a sleep disorder as well. And so if you're falling somewhere between 6 to 9 hours most nights, and it's good quality, refreshing sleep, you're likely okay. So that's, now sleep needs definitely decrease or increase depending on age. So a lot of my elderly patients, I do counsel them, you know, some of the sleep issues you're experiencing, maybe you're only sleeping 5 or 6 hours at night, and now you're sleeping an hour during the day. That can actually look normal. That can actually be normal for someone as their brain gets older and ages. And so a lot of times it's just reassuring patients, no, this is actually normal. If it doesn't bother you to, you know, sleep 6 hours a night and then 1 hour during the daytime, it doesn't necessarily mean we need to treat this in any way. And certainly our school age kids and younger have different sleep needs. Middle school to adolescents typically need at least 8, sometimes up to 12 hours, depending on where they are on that age range. And then, you know, our toddlers and preschoolers need up to 12 to 14 hours.
Are naps beneficial?
In general, yes. There is. So we mentioned the circadian rhythm. There's actually a very physiological basis for naps. Are one of the other Zeitgebers or signals to the circadian rhythm on when to sleep and when to wake is our body temperature. And there's a natural dip in the basal body temperature in the early afternoon. And I'm sure a lot of people have heard of the concept of a siesta, you know, in places like Spain and Portugal and even France and Italy, where a lot of businesses will close down for a couple hours, people will go home, a lot of people will take a nap during the early afternoon. And there is a natural physiological basis in the circadian rhythm. So doesn't mean you have to take a nap during this time. It doesn't mean it's, you know, would improve your health. But certainly if you're kind of pushing the boundaries as an adult, so say you're maybe getting 6 or 6.5 hours of sleep at nighttime, but maybe it's work that's getting you up a little earlier than you'd like to, but then you do have a chance to catch a 30-minute nap in the afternoon, that can be perfectly physiological, meaning normal for the body. And the time that naps can be not so beneficial are if you're sleeping more than an hour in the afternoon, that will typically affect nighttime sleep. Or if the nap is, you know, a common thing for my elderly patients is they get real sleepy a little too early, 5, 6 p.m. for what they'd like. And they're, you know, post-dinner, watching a television show, and they just have this irresistible urge to fall asleep. They fall asleep for 45 minutes to an hour, and then they have trouble sleeping at night. And that can be a common problem. And so that's actually something we can do something about in sleep medicine. Sometimes we'll actually recommend they get a bright light device for their home to keep by their chair to kind of stimulate the brain to stay awake until a little bit of a later time. So naps can be beneficial, but occasionally they can cause some problems too.
We've been talking about quantity of sleep the last few minutes. What about quality? I mean, if someone is in bed for 8 or 9 hours a night, but their quality of sleep is just not that good, how do you define good quality restful sleep?
Yeah, so quality is very important as well. So it's not just the off-on switch. I use the analogy of a dimmer switch. We have different layers, different levels of sleep, stage 1, 2, and 3, as well as what we say is rapid eye movement sleep or REM sleep. And different things occur at each of these levels. Light sleep, your lightest stage is stage 1. Most adults spend less than 5% of their night transitioning into and out of sleep, which is stage 1. Stage 2 is, again, a pretty light sleep, but it's where most adults spend most of their night, about 50% of the night in stage 2 sleep. Stage 3 sleep is slow wave sleep, delta sleep. It has a couple names. And this is where growth hormone is secreted every night. So it's important to get enough of this sleep to repair the body. About 20% of the night for an adult is spent in this stage. And that dream sleep or REM, rapid eye movement sleep, about 25% of the night should be in rapid eye movement sleep. And, you know, most people won't know these exact percentages. For better or for worse, some people are tracking their sleep with wearable devices. And I do get patients very concerned that my watch or whatever is saying I'm not getting enough deep sleep. And I say, well, these wearable devices are very good at general trends. They're not so good at your specific stages. The only way to know that is to do a sleep study and actually measure the brain waves to know what stage of sleep you're in. And more often than not, I when a patient shares their wearable device data with me, I certainly go over it with them. But then when we do a sleep study, I'll do a little post-analysis comparison so they can see that, yeah, when we were actually measuring your brain waves, it differs quite a lot from what your watch says. So quality is based on, are you getting the right amounts of the right types of sleep?
A lot of people complain about not being able to get to sleep or insomnia. Now, there is a difference, I'm sure, between the two from a scientific standpoint. But if someone can't get to sleep, what kind of tips can you give them?
Yeah, so insomnia is actually the most common sleep disorder reported. Now, there's a difference between acute and chronic insomnia. Acute insomnia is usually situational, the death of a relative, the ending of a relationship, the changing of jobs. You know, some stressor in life is disrupting your sleep. Usually, this resolves within 3 months without any intervention. So that's kind of, I'll focus more on chronic insomnia, which I think what most patients who are going to come to a sleep clinic would probably be experiencing. And this is three nights per week for 3 months or more, having difficulty falling asleep, staying asleep, or both. And this is a difficult condition for a lot of reasons. It's difficult because there is this paradox that's very well documented and understood, where the person experiencing their sleep, it's not always a great representation of what's actually occurring. It's called paradoxical insomnia. So the patient thinks, I hear all the time, I don't sleep at all. Okay. And, or I only sleep an hour or two. And when I hear this, I know that the patient's expressing how they feel rather than probably what's actually occurring neurologically. Because if someone was experiencing no sleep at all or only an hour or two for months on end or years on end, they wouldn't be able to, you know, sit upright and talk to me. They would be dead. You know, sleep deprivation of that extreme, it would not be be compatible with life. And so a lot of insomnia is reassuring people, well, I know you're struggling, I know you feel bad, but some of this is more how you feel than what's occurring neurologically in the brain. And it's really hard to, even now, it's hard to explain, you know, that paradox. And so the other thing that can be difficult to convey about insomnia to patients is most of the time there's some other problem that's either causing or precipitating the insomnia. And so I focus a lot of my attention on finding those issues. And a lot of the time it's low-hanging fruit. I'll just say there are four main areas that we can look to that disrupt our sleep. So an undiagnosed sleep disorder. In my clinic, that's probably a lot more common than the general population. But certainly there's a lot of sleep apnea out there that's undiagnosed. And certainly that, if you're not breathing well, I tell patients, the brain eventually learns that it's not getting enough oxygen and will keep you from sleeping because the brain wants oxygen and needs a lot of it, right? And so undiagnosed sleep disorders, one. Just run-of-the-mill medical problems, things like a hurting back, a hurting neck, a rash that's itching. Simple medical issues can disrupt your sleep, right, and perpetuate insomnia. So I say, well, we might need to get your primary care doctor involved to work on some of those issues with you, right? Then there's mental health. Our mental health and our sleep are so intrinsically entwined. Sometimes it's hard to pick out which is bothering the other, right? Is it the poor mental health that's causing the sleep issues, or is it the poor sleep issues causing the mental health, or both? And they can kind of cycle.
Dr. Levery, I'm going to have to interrupt you. I wish we had more time. Dr. John Levery is a sleep medicine physician and systems medical director of sleep medicine at UPM Neurological Institute. Dr. Levery, thank you very much for being with us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.